Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Randy Barnett. He's a Georgetown law professor and the author of the book, most recently, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Randy, thanks for talking.
Great to be here, Nick.
All right, well, let's get right to the book, Our Republican Constitution. Republican is not capital R. It's not a partisan thing. You talk about a Democratic Constitution and a Republican Constitution, understandings. What is the Democratic Constitution and why is it important?
The two different conceptions of the Constitution stem from two different visions of what we the people means. We the people could either be taken collectively as a group, and if it's taken collectively as a group, the only way we the people can govern is by democratic majoritarianism. Right. So it leads to a democratic conception of the Constitution.
And meaning like demos or the mob.
Yeah.
I mean that the majority
rules. Well,
the
group and the majority. The only if the concept of popular sovereignty means that we the people must govern, then the only way we the people can govern is by a majority rule.
Right.
And then it's through representatives who themselves are supposed to represent the majority
right.
view.
So then what's the Republican counterweight to
Well,
that?
It's interesting. One of the reasons for writing the book is that this other democratic vision of we the people is so obvious and well-known that people can't even imagine what the alternative might be. But it turns out there are always was an alternative, and it's we the people based on individuals, or what I say is we the people, each and every one.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the view of we the people, each and every one as individuals, and you follow the Declaration of Independence, which I have a chapter
right.
devoted to, it's that first come rights, and then it is, in the words of the Declaration, to secure these rights.
You mentioned the Declaration of Independence, but first off, why? Why does the Declaration of Independence matter in relation to the Constitution? Because the Constitution is the founding document of the United States of America, right? Not the Declaration?
Well, the Declaration was the founding document of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had the Articles of Confederation,
right.
and then we had the Constitution. We had two different forms of government here since
mm-hmm.
we separated
right.
from Great Britain. But the reason why I appeal to the Declaration is because I'm trying to show that this individual conception of we the people has as long a heritage as the democratic or majoritarian one, the one that we the people as a group, and you see it in the Declaration. It is to secure these pre-existing rights that governments are instituted among men. If you take that view, then it's not so much that we the people govern, that's not what that's not what popular sovereignty means. Popular sovereignty means that it's the rights of the individual person that needs to be protected by government, mm-hmm. and then the people control or they limit government. But government is not the same as us.
Right.
They're a small subset of us. They're the governors, and the reason we have a constitution is to provide the law that governs them.
This is not something that necessarily follows in terms of conservative or liberal conceptions, right? Because somebody like Robert Bork, a very conservative jurist, was in most ways a majoritarian. That as long as, you know, if a law was passed by an assembly or a legislature that had been properly elected, they could pretty much do whatever they wanted.
Yes. I mean, this is a book. It's a popular book, that we should point out. My other books have been more academic, published by Oxford or Princeton. This is a popular book published by HarperCollins, intended for a general audience. And if I had to say who the direct target of the book was, and in some sense who the audience is, it's conservative Republicans, or it's conservatives in the United States today, who have accepted, in some sense, unthinkingly, this progressive or democratic vision of the Constitution and made that part of their own. There are sometimes no more strident adherence to the democratic Constitution than some judicial conservative Republicans.
And talk about that in terms of, you use the terms or the phrases judicial restraint, which I think people are somewhat well known or versed in, and then judicial engagement as opposed to judicial activism. But judicial restraint is part of the democratic Constitution. Judicial engagement part of the Republican country.
Right, because the argument for judicial restraint is that unelected, unaccountable judges should not be getting in the way of Democratic majorities unless they have some really good reason for doing so. For example, if the Constitution has an express prohibition, the Constitution itself speaks for the majority, so judges can follow that. This is a very majoritarian view of what judges are supposed to do. Leading to a doctrine of judicial restraint, which is not an interpretation of the Constitution, it's simply a vision of what judges' proper role is.
Mm-hmm.
Judicial engagement, which is a term that has been popularized by the Institute for Justice, is the idea that judges, and as explained in the book, judges are too are servants of the people, and their job is to be an independent tribunal of justice when a member of the sovereign public gets into a dispute with the legislature, who are their servants, as to whether the legislature is acting within its proper powers. The public ought to be able to go to a neutral judge who's not going to put his finger on the scale for one side or the other and have that issue determined, and that is what we're calling judicial engagement.
Talk about how this also intersects with concepts of original intent or originalism, because these are also phrases that, for those of us who are not trained in law, you know, it gets difficult to understand.
It's very simple. This is the Constitution. If the Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us, mm-hmm. then those who govern us should no more be able to change the law that governs them mm-hmm. than we are able to unilaterally change the speed limits that govern us. They need to go through the amendment process. So originalism is simply the proposition that the meaning of this must remain the same until it's properly changed.
Right. And it's explained in the Constitution how those changes happen.
Right, exactly. Now, this is not a book. This is not a book about originalism.
Right.
My last book was about originalism. Originalism plays very little role in this book, but it is underlying the whole idea of why we have a written constitution.
And it's important to understand. I mean, that when people invoke originalism the way you're talking about it, it's not like they're biblical literalists and they're saying if you know it's in the Constitution or not. I mean, the specific words or things like that. It's actually about the process by which laws or by which the scope of government is amended.
Yes, the argument is that every word of the Constitution should be followed according to the meaning it had when it was enacted, and it was enacted at different times. The 14th Amendment was enacted in the 1860s. Right. So it is about following the words of the Constitution. It is not about following the intentions of those who wrote the words in the sense of what they expected would happen. This is what's sometimes called original expected applications. It's not about that. It's not about, well, what would they think about gay marriage, or what would they think about freedom of contract. That's not what this is about. It's about what they said, not what they, how they thought what they said might be used in the future.
You've talked in the past, or you've written about how bizarrely, I mean, now it seems, and it's partly a tribute to Antonin Scalia, the recently deceased Supreme Court Justice's impact. Before him, there wasn't all that much attention paid to the actual texts of the Constitution or of laws being written. How did that happen? And then how was it through force of personality that he was able to say, hey, look, you know, we're supposed to be reading this stuff?
I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but I'm certain it did happen. When he became a justice, the court was paying almost no attention to the text of the Constitution. You could have whole big Supreme Court opinions that didn't even talk about the text and what it might mean. That's no longer the case. The variable, I think, that's changed here is Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas together joining the court, because Justice Thomas is every bit as much a committed originalist, if not more, than Justice Scalia was. And now, recently, Justice Alito has just revealed that he himself is also originalist. I was on a program with him at Georgetown. I introduced him, and the dean was asking him questions just like this, and he asked him what his approach to the Constitution was. He says, well, I'm an originalist. And that's the first time that I've heard him describe himself as an originalist.
Where does Scalia fall in the realm of judicial restraint versus judicial engagement?
He's kind of in the middle. I think, because of his history, he came through the restraint period, and restraint period still affected him. But I do think that he was pretty stalwart about where there is an express prohibition, an expressed right in the Constitution, that it ought to be enforced, with qualifications that he also believed in, like standing requirements and other things. And so he was kind of in the middle of this, and there are some, like, for example, Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who have argued that even the Heller decision protecting the individual right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment is an activist decision. So that's the extreme deference that once pervaded the conservative legal movement, but no longer pervades the conservative legal movement.
Before we go on to talk about your specific experiences in cases argued in front of the Supreme Court, let me follow up when you talk about the 14th Amendment and you add 15th, 16th. At a certain point when the Bill of Rights was applied to the states, broadly speaking, what is left for the states to do if, in fact, they have to defer to the United States Constitution?
Well, plenty. In fact, this is discussed in the book in Chapter 9, I think, where I talk about irrational and arbitrary laws. The Constitution and our whole system of government presupposes that our liberties may be regulated. But those regulations have to be for the purpose of protecting each one of our rights, each one of our liberties. And so regulations are sometimes what you might think of as before the fact, saying afterwards you could be sued for tort, but before the fact you shouldn't be able to build a building that doesn't meet certain kinds of standards. this is not a libertarian world necessarily, but it is a world of reasonable regulation. But if the regulation is not reasonable, if it's actually irrational or arbitrary, meaning it isn't really there to serve the health and safety purposes mm-hmm. of the public, but maybe it's there just to help out certain interest groups as opposed to others, then that's beyond the just powers of a legislature to enact. Mm-hmm. Legislators must be trying to regulate to protect against harms caused by individual conduct in good faith, not simply to help out their buddies.
How is the discovery process of that, though? Is it the results, or is it, you know, in legislation where you're in the legislative history? And I know one of the examples that you talk about has to do with eyewear, like restrictions, state level restrictions
right.
on, you know, on what is it, Lee Optical or
yes,
whatever.
That's right.
Yeah. So, you know, and this is going back a few years before we had, you know, various kinds of lens crafter or national chains. And there's some of these laws still kind of exist of where, oh, you can't just sell your own eyeglasses. You need to go through this rigorous and ridiculous state licensing process, et cetera, et cetera. Why isn't, you know, why do we know that that's a ridiculous or arbitrary restraint on economics or on business rather than something else?
I think courts need to be realistic about the origins of these laws, but then with that realism in mind, then they just have to look and see whether there's some kind of fit mm-hmm. or what kind of fit is there between the means that were adopted and the ends that they're supposed to achieve. If they find that fit is not really there, or if they find that certain people are being treated differently than other people for reasons that can't really be explained, that's what an irrational and arbitrary law is. An irrational law is one that doesn't really fit the purposes. Is you're literally acting irrationally. You say you're doing it for this reason, but it isn't really doing it. Or arbitrary, because you're treating this person differently than that person, similarly situated. That's sort of the outer boundary of what the people can be said to have consented to when they're not being asked directly for their consent.
Can we ever separate out, you know, that sense of, well, this is, you know, arbitrary or this is ridiculous, from social context? Because when you think of something like Plessy versus Ferguson or some of these economic rights cases where it's like, no, well, you shouldn't be allowed to sell caskets to somebody out of state or whatever, you know, these seem ridiculous now. The idea that you would say, okay, well, you know, a black man can't buy a first class railroad ticket. But in 1896, you know, maybe nobody would, you know, very few people would have said, oh, that's totally arbitrary, or it doesn't serve a real social purpose.
A lot of people said it was arbitrary. The railroad companies didn't like the idea mm-hmm. of having to put on separate cars and make their employees insult their customers by telling mm-hmm. them they had to ride in the second car. A lot of people objected to it, but by that point, the Supreme Court had basically enforced the Democratic Constitution, which mm-hmm. deferred to local police power majoritarian rule. And the rationality of that statute in Plessy was treated in two sentences in that opinion. That basically it was to preserve social order, end of story, no discussion of context, no discussion if there had been a problem with social order beforehand, which there hadn't been. And so that's exactly the kind of deference that my book argues against, and I talk about Plessy mm-hmm. in the book.
Well, let's talk about the Obamacare decision. You are, and you know, possibly, I mean, this reads almost like a legal thriller. The opening section of the book is phenomenal, and it recounts your role in coming up with the legal defense or the legal argument against the individual mandate in Obamacare, which obviously didn't go the way that most libertarians, and I would hope, you know, most Americans actually want, the idea that we can be mandated to engage a certain type of economic activity against our will. You've written that Obamacare is actually a partial win. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Right. Well, you have to distinguish between the law and the outcome. Normally, if you win on the law, you also win on the outcome. And if you lose on the outcome, it means you've also lost right. on the law. This is a very strange circumstance where we won on the law and still lost on the outcome.
Okay. So, I mean, because
the win on the law yeah. was what you just said. Government does not have the power to make you buy a good and service. That the five votes agreed with us about that. They said it's beyond the commerce power. Mm-hmm. It's beyond the commerce power as enhanced by the Necessary and Proper Clause. It's an improper means of Congress asserting its enumerated powers. We won. We won. And then what Chief Justice Roberts did is he changed the law mm-hmm. so that it wasn't a mandate anymore. It was an option. It was an option. You can pay this small tax that's non-coercive, in his opinion, had to be non-coercive, otherwise it's...
And is it non-coercive because it's small?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So at what point, when it builds up to...
You have to ask Chief Justice Roberts. Okay. You can't ask
I'll get him on... he's coming in next.
Yes, so and I'm sure he has a book to promote.
Are the legal challenges to Obamacare done?
Well, because it's such a big law, it's constantly going to be bumping up against one provision of the Constitution or another. Right now, we have the religious exemption issue for some people for paying for abortions and abortion-related services. So a big law like this is constantly going to have problems, but in terms of, we're not going to get rid of Obamacare in the courts. That's
it will now have clear. To be done legislatively,
yes.
if at all.
Right. Yeah. And one of the purposes, another way in which our case was a win, it was a big win on the law. We would have made terrible law if the court had adopted the government's reason for upholding Obamacare, but they didn't. They adopted our reason. But it's another win because we kept the law in legitimacy limbo for several years. And in some respects, it's still in legitimacy limbo. Normally, once a social welfare program gets implemented, it's politically impossible to repeal it. But our lawsuit was part of what kept that law controversial to this day.
And recount how you came up with the, you know, what was the kind of light bulb going off where you realize, okay, there is a, you know, that the individual mandate is really up for questioning in a serious way.
It happened on a blog. I was a member of the Politico's blog called The Arena. I don't think it exists anymore. And one morning, and there'd been a Wall Street Journal piece on why Obamacare was unconstitutional, which had not persuaded me. And then I woke up in the morning and I checked my handheld and I saw that there was a very snarky post by this law professor about why no serious person could question the constitutionality of this, which got me kind of riled up.
Right.
You know, I sometimes get that way in social
media. And you know it was
media.
Wrong and you just had to find the...
No, I just said, come on, this guy's like, you know, like he was equating the Constitution with the Supreme Court. He said the Constitution the Supreme Court has given up, blah, blah, blah. And it just annoyed me. And so I thought, okay, fine. Let's start with what the Constitution says. It's not in here anywhere. And it's sort of like one thing led to another as I was crafting this blog post. It's just sort of, the argument just sort of got made in the course of writing a blog post.
Now, in the book, you talk about how you were happy not to be the one actually doing the oral argument.
And my wife was really happy.
But that leads to a different case that also has a lot to do with the Commerce Clause, the Raich case about medical marijuana in California and whether or not the federal government had the right to regulate that. And you did argue that case.
Yes.
And that one went against you 6-3. If we won in the Obamacare case, how did we possibly lose in the Raich case?
It's actually a completely different legal issue. There was nothing improper about the means that Congress was using. The only to enforce its law, which is the normal criminal law to enforce a prohibition, the only issue is whether they could reach inside a state and tell individuals what to do because their conduct would affect interstate commerce.
Sure, and, hypothetically.
Yeah.
Because that's, I mean, this is... It's hard to say that anybody growing pot in their backyard is really affecting the interstate.
That was our argument, Nick.
Yeah.
That's what we said.
Hey, well, you won
and
me
we
over.
Got and we got three votes. We won Justice O'Connor over and Justice Thomas and Chief Justice Rehnquist. We had all three of them.
Yeah.
But we lost Justice Scalia. And it took me a while to get over that.
Yeah.
I wrote a pretty harsh treatment of Justice Scalia after that. And we lost Justice Kennedy for reasons he never articulated. Mm-hmm. He just joined the majority opinion, never defended himself. And basically, what Justice Scalia did, getting back to your earlier question, is he deferred to Congress's judgment that you needed to reach homegrown marijuana in order to effectively regulate interstate commerce.
Right.
So it's when he took the deference turn, that's when we lost him.
Yeah.
So it comes back exactly to that point, and your question earlier about whether he's a deference guy or not, he was a deference guy when
at
it came
least in that case,
in that case as
and
he was in other cases.
Yeah. And then in other places, he was like, no, the government just doesn't really, can't legitimate a right to
infringe. But you know, he changed.
Yeah.
We've all changed. We all change. I've changed. And he's changed. He was growing in what I would say my direction.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I started off not being an originalist and became an originalist after he did. So in some respects, I kind of grew a little bit in his direction.
What, you know, just personally, what is it like? I mean, you talked about it's nerve-wracking to be in front of the Supreme Court, but it's also kind of like, you know, that's like being on Broadway if you're a lawyer. What's it like to lose? I mean, how does that, you know, is it crushing? Is it like, you know?
In that case, I knew we'd lost because I could tell from the tenor of the questioning that we lost. After weeks have passed before the opinion came out, I could convince myself, well, maybe Justice Scalia really wasn't going to vote against us after all. Maybe he was just asking me questions. But I knew that day. All the questioning that I got from the bench were from justices that voted against us. Mm-hmm. The three friendly justices, Chief Justice Rehnquist was sick that day, so he didn't ask me questions. Justice Thomas doesn't ask questions. And for whatever reason, Justice O'Connor didn't choose to give me any helpful questions. So I had a very hard day. I think I held up, but under severe questioning. And I knew. In the Obamacare case, we felt we'd won it. And in fact, reporting shows we did win it.
So how do you know?
We won it initially, and then Chief Justice Roberts changed his vote after the original conference.
How do you know that? I mean, is that from a textual analysis, or are you reading tea leaves there?
It was reported by a reporter, a very good reporter of the Supreme Court, from her sources that this is what had happened.
And do we know why he changed his mind?
We don't, because it's a secret that he even did it, that he even changed his mind, and and her sources didn't say.
Yeah.
I only know what I know from her sources.
Does Roberts tend to be deferential to, is he a Democratic constitutionalist?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he was recently in the gay marriage case, and he talked about how evil Lochner was in the gay marriage case.
Explain for us Lochner.
Well, Lochner is this famous or infamous case from the early 1900s in which the court invalidated a maximum hours law for bakers. And it really wasn't that big a deal at the time, but Teddy Roosevelt, and I talk about this in the book actually, Teddy Roosevelt made it a campaign issue when he ran for president as a progressive in 1912, and he made judicial restraint a big theme of his movement, and he had put Oliver Wendell Holmes on the Supreme Court when he is president as a Republican, and Holmes had this hugely restrained outlook towards what judges should be doing.
And it's just to keep it straight in my mind, it's just that if the legislature does it, it's okay.
Right. Only if no reasonable person could agree with it is it not okay. But there's always a reasonable person, like Justice Holmes would say, well, I'm a reasonable person, and I think it's okay, so therefore it's okay.
Right.
So unless you can, unless it's a law that no reasonable person could possibly think was within the legislative power, it's okay.
Right.
And so Teddy Roosevelt, when he was running for president, and he was quoting Holmes and talking about Judge Holmes and how a great justice he was, he started talking about the bake shop case. And made it a big political issue.
He was mad that they had invalidated, that the Supreme Court had invalidated the legislature's right to say, no, you can't work more than a certain number of
hours. Exactly, right. And so he made it a big public issue. And from then on in, it had a political salience that it didn't have really before 1912. And for many on the right, as well as people on the left, the Lochner case is the paradigm example of the Supreme Court having overreached. In a very, very inappropriate way. And I remember when I was a law student and I got to that case and I was reading it in the case book and I would read for the night before. I had Larry Tribe as my con law professor, who was an excellent teacher. And I would be reading the cases and I would come across a case like the Lochner case. And I don't specifically remember that one, but I know the whole thing. I'd read it and go, wow, this is great. I can't believe how great this opinion is. And then I would like turn the page and say, but it's evil.
Yeah.
This is why it's wrong. Right. Wait a second. I like that case. So I do say somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but only somewhat, that it's my favorite Supreme Court case. And that just gets the dander up.
And you obviously never worked at a bakery or for a Dunkin' Donuts or something.
I worked in a laundry.
Okay. So there you go. So you
it was very hot in that laundry.
To switch gears a little bit, you have in the long
course. Well, let me say this about the Lochner case. And this goes back to your statement about what reasonable regulation is and what it's not, what's irrational. That particular provision was part of a very large and comprehensive regulation of bake shops called the Bake Shop Act. There were all kinds of health and safety rules in that act. How high the ceilings had to be, whether the floors, what the floors had to be made of, whether the walls had to be whitewashed, what kind of animals could be in the vicinity, cats only, where the washrooms would be, what the ventilation would be. Where people would sleep relative to where the bake shop, where the ovens were. All of this was in the act. None of it was challenged. All of it is mentioned in the majority opinion as perfectly okay, reasonable regulations of the health and safety. This one provision only, which was put into the law at the behest of the bake shop unions, was singled out because it did not have an obvious relationship to health and safety. And the arguments that were being made on its behalf, the court thought, were not credible. Why? Because they knew, and in fact, the evidence showed that it really was there to side with the organized unions in the bigger bake shop case, the bigger bakeries, against these small mom and pop ethnic bakeries that didn't want to unionize. So that's what the court was getting in the middle of there, was that sort of controversy. Because it lacked a health and safety rationale, they didn't uphold it. But they in fact, it wasn't challenged, but they mentioned that the rest of the act was perfectly fine.
Now, in
so I just want to say this supposed extreme Lochner case, they're the worst of the worst of the worst. As far as they were concerned, the health and safety regulations of the bake shop industry was perfectly okay.
Where would you be if you were deciding that now? Because, you know, would you be okay? And this is also in the 19-teens, this is, you know, when cities are filling up factories and large buildings are first being used in cramped quarters. There's things like the Shirtwaist Triangle Factory fire. So would you be okay with a lot of these other safety regulations?
As a matter of the United States Constitution, including the 14th Amendment, if I were a judge and those were good faith health and safety regulations, I would uphold them.
Yeah.
That's what the Lochner Court did. I would do what the Lochner Court did. And that shows how reasonable I am.
Well, to turn to a slightly different topic where you may not be considered as reasonable, in your career as a legal scholar and as a commentator, as a radical libertarian person, you've always looked kind of askance at the Libertarian Party or third parties in general,
right,
and said that they're kind of distractions from where change is really going to happen. A couple weeks ago in USA Today, you wrote that if Donald Trump wins the Republican nomination, or wins the presidency, that a third party should crop up. You said it should be called the American Constitution Party. Why should there be a third party, and what should its basic principles be?
First, I should say that when the Libertarian, I wasn't smart enough to know all this when the Libertarian Party was formed. I was rah-rah, go Libertarian Party. I went to the Libertarian Party National Convention in New York. And I don't remember who the candidate, I'd have to go back and check which candidate was nominated there, but that's the one where Ed Crane was involved and Murray Rothbard was involved and Robert Nozick was still involved in the Libertarian Party. It was very exciting to be a part of all of that. And I cast a vote, I think, for Roger McBride back in the day. So this has not always been my view, but I have subsequently come to realize that we have, for better or worse, a two-party system based on the laws that govern our elections.
We're always going to have two dominant parties.
The laws are rigged for a two-party system. Unless you change the laws, this is what we've got. And the winner is the one that's the first past the post. They get the office. And so if you have a third party, it's generally going to pull votes away from the party it's closest to and help the party it's farthest from. So the logic of a third party makes it more likely that the worst candidate of the two major parties will get elected.
Okay, so that explains why you're against third parties in general.
Yes.
So what is the specific threat that is that is posed by Donald Trump?
Because he's an authoritarian who doesn't believe in the Constitution or anything other than his own ego. And
we know this how?
From listening to him.
Just listen
to what the man says. He doesn't keep his story straight from one minute to the next minute. He says whatever pops into his head at the moment. He's a dangerous demagogue. If I were somebody who cared about the immigration laws the way his supporters do, I wouldn't trust Donald Trump to deliver anything for me because he'll just make a deal. He's already basically announced that. So, at any rate, he's a dangerous demagogue.
Yeah.
Costing him the election is a good thing.
What do you think about somebody like Ted Cruz, you know, Harvard law grad, talks about the Constitution in between, you know, every other sentence, every other word. He has essentially the same immigration policy. He wants to kick out 12 million people. He says Trump is soft on immigration because he would let some of those people back in. How would we enforce a law like that without becoming an authoritarian government? And also, if Trump, and I think you're right, he clearly doesn't give a shit about the Constitution. He probably has never read it any more than he's read, you know, both books of the Bible. But, you know, Cruz has said, you know, he's against birthright citizenship. Cruz has said that he believes in retention elections for judges. How is that different from kind of Trump ignoring the Constitution?
Well, first of all, as you know, I was an advisor to Senator Paul during the campaign, before his campaign ended, and I was one of the people in the room helping prep him for debates. My opinion of Senator Paul continued to go up the more I was around him. And also, I can tell you, he's a very independent-minded fellow. He took our advice under advisement, shall we say. But I like him so much, and so that was my first choice. I know Ted Cruz, I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's first and foremost a constitutionalist, And for example, when he was asked about the gay marriage case, a gay marriage issue, privately, he was being secretly recorded in a New York fundraiser, mm-hmm. and he was asked about this privately. And what his answer, and the person who was questioning him said, "Was this part of your? Is this one of your top three priorities?" Well, you would say the politically correct answer in conservative Republican circles is to say, "Yeah," but that's not what he said. He said no, and the person who questioned him said, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "The Constitution is my top priority," mm-hmm. and under that vision, under his vision of the Constitution, marriage is a thing for states to decide.
So then why was he backing Kim Davis? He was on a stage with her, the Kentucky County Commissioner.
Look, I can't speak to everything that Ted Cruz does. But I can tell you that his position was that that the Supreme Court erred in taking marriage laws away from the states. I had a brief in the mm-hmm. Windsor case that argued exactly that, mm-hmm. Arguing the DOMA is unconstitutional because DOMA takes, the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional because it takes marriage away from the states where it belongs. And so his position on gay marriage constitutionally is the same as what my position was constitutionally.
Yeah, so the difference between somebody like Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, despite many similarities in policy and preferred outcomes necessarily, is that he believes in the Constitution.
Right, and I think he will appoint judges who also believe in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Now, we could go back and, if I have a doubt about him, it would be back to our restraint versus originalism.
Yeah, because he yammers on a lot about unelected judges.
Well, I don't know if he does. I take your word for that. I haven't seen him yammer about that. But the but I don't see that. But I would say that just knowing his history, I would sort of presume, without knowing, that maybe he's part of this restraint tradition that so many people like Chief Justice Roberts is. Mm-hmm. But look, I think that Obamacare, let's get back to that for a minute. I think that politically, that decision was a watershed moment. It was a defining moment, a critical moment in our intellectual history, our political history. Up to that point, restraint, everybody was sort of on board with that. After that point, building up to it, restraint didn't look so good. And the one thing Ted Cruz has admitted he was wrong about, and he doesn't admit he's wrong about very much, it was his support for Chief Justice Roberts. He says that was a mistake. That's huge, since he doesn't admit that many mistakes.
We're going through a kind of non-confirmation period. Do you think that...
Of my section mate in law school, Merrick Garland.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you, is Merrick Garland Supreme Court worthy, and is it wrong to deny him even a confirmation hearing?
Merrick Garland, who was my classmate, was one of the stars of the section. He was one of the gunners in the class that would challenge the professors the entire year. We all looked up to him and a couple other people who were like in that upper echelon. And is a very, very decent human being. Would be a wonderful adherent to the Democratic Constitution. Mm-hmm. He is a deference guy par excellence. He defers to the EPA. He defers to administrative agencies. That guy defers like crazy. And for that reason, as a matter of judicial philosophy, I think he would not be a good justice for us to have. Now, so I would be opposed to him.
Well,
on character and fitness grounds and ability grounds, he has. But you see, part of the problem is evaluating justices on basis of so-called qualifications. Mm-hmm. As long as everybody was in agreement in the Democratic Constitution, the post-New Deal understanding of what constitutions should be, which Republicans and Democrats were all in agreement about, then at that point, all you're interested in is qualifications. How smart are you? How good are you? Because everybody basically agrees. But now we have a fundamental disagreement about the Constitution, starting with the Scalia appointment, and I mean, to some extent with Rehnquist, but also Rehnquist, then Scalia, then Thomas. We have a disagreement about the Constitution. Now, qualifications aren't enough. What you need is what Joe Biden used to say you have to look for, and that is judicial philosophy. Right. And that gets us back to originalism. Right. That is what a justice should be, an originalist, first and foremost.
Let me ask, and this is...
So let me just say, qualifications are necessary, but they're not sufficient.
This is a political question, not a legal one or a judicial one, but does it make sense for, then, is it legitimate for the Republican Senate, essentially, to forestall, to run the clock out on Garland's appointment or confirmation possibility? Is it legal to do that? And I guess it is, but is it proper to do that simply because you don't want to give the sitting president a shot at it?
It's every bit as constitutional. I mean, it's completely constitutional. In fact, I haven't heard a serious argument. Nobody makes a serious argument that it's not constitutionally permitted. It's all an argument about, as you say, whether it's proper or not.
Right.
And the Senate is as entitled to veto or fail to consent to a nominee as the president is to select somebody. The president did not select me or someone like me.
Right.
He selected my classmate Merrick.
Yeah.
And therefore, he discriminated against me. He went with Merrick instead. And it's perfectly appropriate for the Senate to say we disagree about him. And whether there needs to be a hearing or not, actually, at that point, I would say there should not be a hearing because given that we are in the election cycle, given that this appointment is going to last far beyond this president's tenure, it's something that ought to be made an issue at the next election. It's something that the people as voters, the electorate, should have a say-so in how this court's going to look in the future.
Can we talk a bit about how you developed your ideas and the larger libertarian legal movement? A couple of weeks ago at the Students for Liberty Conference, George Will was on a panel with myself and Matt Welch, and Will was totally pessimistic. We were saying, okay, well, what's next for the libertarian moment? And he's like, no, we're in an authoritarian moment. One of the few bright spots is the libertarian legal movement led by people like yourself. What is the libertarian legal moment, and then movement rather, and talk a little bit about how you became part of it and what constitutes it?
Well, first of all, I should mention George Will wrote an extremely flattering laudatory
intro
foreword
to your book
that
you
didn't get a chance to read because it wasn't in the galleys. But I've read it, and it's like, wow. I mean, I would never have had the nerve to write this about myself. I will forever be grateful to George Will for this.
And he is somebody who's kind of moved from a majoritarian perspective to the idea that the Constitution is a rights document that really puts limits on government.
Yeah, he's totally moved. And as his conservative critics will remind him whenever he speaks on behalf of judicial engagement, they'll trot out all the old quotes from the Nixon days in which he was going the other way.
And, I mean, that's kind of the nub of a libertarian legal movement, right? I mean, it's your definition of we the people as individuals as opposed to a kind of majoritarian democratic constitution.
Right. Well, this book is somewhat of a manifesto for that, although Clark Neely's book, Terms of Engagement, is really a manifesto for that. This is something a little bit broader and bigger, but along the same lines. It is intended to be a manifesto for what you might call the right of the American political spectrum. It's arguing why their unreflected adherence to this progressive idea of judicial restraint and only enforcing the enumerated rights and not protecting liberty generally is something that a conservative should be for. It's an argument for that side of the political spectrum. And as you say, it's an argument for political action. I mean, the hope was it would come out earlier than this and it would somehow inform the political debate we're now having, hopefully coming out in April before the November election will be soon enough to have some influence.
So, but talk about where you came from. When I was scouring around, and we've engaged each other over the years and whatnot, but, on Wikipedia, I know you were born in 1952. I'm not even sure where. Your hometown's not listed. You went to Northwestern as an undergrad, Harvard for law school. You taught at Kent College of Law, which is part of Illinois Institute of Technology, Boston University, or at Georgetown.
Right.
You were big in the Federalist Society. You have connections to the Institute for Humane Studies.
I was a Cook County State's Attorney.
Okay,
I was a criminal prosecutor
go.
In Chicago from 1977 to 81.
All right. So
I was born in Chicago.
Okay. And where, were you always libertarian inclined?
Yeah.
And talk about your early entry into that kind of world.
I was a liberty. There's like two general strains of conservatism, tradition-based and liberty-based. And I was a liberty-based one. I got my principles from my dad. That's where they came from.
What did he do?
He was in the laundry business. That's how I ended up working in the laundry. And his dad
So definitely, no, you couldn't sue to have a cap on your hours.
No, it was very hot in
the
laundry.
Yeah.
There was no air conditioning back then in the summer. So on the south side of Chicago is where his business was. I grew up in a place called Calumet City, which is a south suburb, is a very working class, blue collar, primarily Polish Catholic town on the border with Indiana. Most of the people there worked in the mills or in the refineries in northwest Indiana. When I was 12 years old, in my junior high school, I debated in front of the entire student body on behalf of Barry Goldwater. And I remember I had to ride a bicycle. There was no Republican, there's no internet.
Right.
So to get information, you couldn't get it from the media. So I had, you'd have to get it from the Republican
party. And there were
party.
No Republicans,
no
on
Republicans
the south side
in Calumet City.
Yeah.
I had to ride my bike over to Hammond and go to the Republican office and pick up brochures.
In Hammond, Indiana.
Hammond, Indiana.
Yeah.
To get this information from my debate. I actually found my notes mm-hmm. from my debate in my files. I have it. So that's it was so Goldwater was like fantastic. It was
extremism
in defense
to?
Of liberty is no vice.
Right.
Moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue.
And do you think libertarians are born or made, or is it a combination? Because obviously, you said your father was a kind of...
He was a proto-libertarian. He
yeah.
became, when I became a real libertarian in college, I expected to go home and get an argument from my dad, because my dad was extremely opinionated. He was he really argued. He always won. He was always right, so it always made it difficult to argue with. Although it was handy, because if he told you something, you could rely on it being true. But he actually changed to be a real libertarian.
And that
more
libertarian rather than kind of traditionalist.
Yeah, yeah. And so I had a long struggle with a junior professor at Northwestern about libertarianism.
What did you major in?
Philosophy.
Okay.
I started off as political science, but I discovered that it was all statistics and empirical stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was going to be political theory, but it wasn't. So then I went to philosophy, and it really was fantastic. Changed my life. And I'm a professor today because of that. So I argued with this John Cody, who was a junior classics professor at Northwestern for about 9 months, and he would carry Mises around with him with his or Anarchy, State, and Utopia around with his marked up thumb thing, and we had this debate. We would meet periodically and debate, and finally, after about 9 months, I thought, well, maybe he's right, and maybe I'm not right about this, and that's when I became a libertarian. And by my senior year, I taught a student. Organized credited seminar in my residential college on libertarianism, where I taught the course.
What years?
I was in college from 70 to 74, so I would have taught that course in 73 or 4.
So what was it like to be a libertarian back then? Because it was, there was a New York Times Magazine story in 70 or 71 about how libertarianism was the next big thing. Libertarian candidate in 1972. Got one electoral vote.
John Hotspur and Toni Nathan.
Yeah.
The first
woman to get
an electoral vote.
So was it a sense where did you feel like you were on the vanguard of something, or did you feel like you were out in the wilderness?
I felt like, it was like when you join the Federalist Society as a student, you find there's other people here that are like me, I'm not alone. And so there were other people. I was somewhat on my own at Northwestern, and then I wrote a fan letter to Murray Rothbard, saying, I'm going to Harvard Law School, maybe someday I might meet you, but here's all the ways in which you influenced me. Hmm. He didn't respond, but he gave a copy of the letter to a classmate of mine, John Hagel, who at that time was president of a new organization called the Center for Libertarian Studies in New York. And John called me up, and he was a first-year law student along with me. And we got to know each other, and then we got tight, and then he brought me down to New York. And that fall of my first year of law school is when I met Murray Rothbard at Fordham, where Leonard Liggio was giving a lecture and Murray was in the audience. And that evening, we actually ended up, John and me and Murray, in Murray's living room, quizzing him about the hypotheticals that were tormenting us as law students.
What, can you remember any of those?
No, all I can remember was his reaction, which was, I'm sitting there in law school hearing all these hypotheticals about, is this right, is that right? And I figured, well, as a good libertarian, I should have a libertarian answer, but I didn't have one. So I thought, well, that's on me. And then we, both of us, gave him these hypotheticals, and Murray Rothbard, Mr. Libertarian, he couldn't answer them either. And that actually planted the seed that, wait a second, maybe these principles are general and they don't answer super specific questions all the time. Maybe there's a difference between law and the more general principles of justice we're trying to see effectuated. But that was a very memorable moment. And then I joined the board of the Center for Libertarian Studies, which was a superstar roster of academics. And maybe it's not a good idea to have a board of directors be all academic intellectuals, because they tend to fight a lot.
Right.
But Murray was there. Murray was on the board, and other people like Ronald Hamaway and Bill Evers. And there's just it was just an all-star lineup. And eventually, Charles Koch joined our board. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first got to know Charles.
And talk about that, because you also have connections with the Institute for Humane Studies, which has been around since the early 60s. And I know I benefited from it. You did as well. And it helped create a kind of a funding source as well as an intellectual resource for libertarians that wouldn't be there otherwise.
Well, I just told you that I came down in the fall of 74 to New York and met Murray. That was my first year of law school. Later on that year, Murray recommended me for a fellowship from what was then called the Law and Liberty Project, run by a man named Davis Keeler, because they had a summer fellowship program. And he recommended me for this program, and then IHS gave, well, I didn't know about IHS, but IHS gave me this fellowship, and it was that summer I wrote my paper, Restitution, A New Paradigm of Criminal Justice, that was published in Ethics by the time I was a third year law student. So my becoming a philosophy major is what first planted the seed of being a professor of something. I thought it might be philosophy. And then writing this article was my first experience doing scholarship. And that came about as a result of Murray Rothbard recommending me to the Institute for Humane Studies. So had it not been for IHS giving me that fellowship, I don't know if I'd be sitting here today.
Talk about Murray Rothbard a bit as a person. He is he was part of virtually every aspect of the libertarian movement while it was around, and he also alienated virtually every aspect of the libertarian movement. What is your memory of him? And obviously, you gained a lot of energy as well as insight from him. But is there more to say about him?
He was an amazing man. I still consider myself basically a Rothbardian. Mm-hmm.
He has a certain. How do you define that?
Well, it's basically property rights are sort of the core of what liberty is about. I ended up getting into a debate with Ronald Dworkin. Dworkin was my jurisprudence professor in law school about the relationship between property and liberty. And he said to me privately, he says, well, you're not a libertarian, you're a propertarian. Because property is fundamental to you. Right. And that really also got me thinking. And I wrote a paper about that for Dworkin. Mm-hmm. But so that's really sort of the Rothbardian, that and other things are the Rothbardian perspective. So he had a huge impact on me. He was a wonderful guy, or he could be a wonderful guy. He also had kind of a dark side that when you deviated from whatever he thought was the line, he allowed a certain amount up to a point. But beyond a certain upon a point, you kind of were dead to him in a way. And at some point, I crossed some line, and I was no longer. At one point, I was his fair-haired boy, so to speak, along with others. And at some point, I wasn't anymore. But I never stopped caring for Murray.
You mentioned Robert Nozick as well as
He was very decent to me when I was a law student also.
Nozick?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, who were the other kind of intellectual lights that lit up your night sky?
Well, Nozick was not one of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we who were Rothbardians looked askance a bit at this anarchy state and utopia business. And it put libertarianism on the map in philosophy and had a huge role to play. And he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for the respectability that libertarianism now has in academia. But the book itself has issues. And I wrote a critique of the book, actually, early on. I wouldn't say that Robert Nozick was a big influence on me, but Murray was definitely one. And eventually Hayekian thought. I never really met Hayek. I was actually on a boat cruise with him one time in Mont Pelerin Society. And so he was sitting next table over. I took a picture of him. That's the closest I came, right?
How do you mean by Hayekian?
Hayekianism has to do with evolutionary notions, spontaneous order, something that really is... plays a big role in IHS intellectual agenda. And so back in the days when I was really in Murray's camp, I mean, Murray didn't care for Milton Friedman very much.
Right.
And Murray didn't care for Hayek very much.
Right.
And so we didn't either. Mm-hmm. But I changed my mind about
but
that.
But then the idea of Hayek is that you don't need as many top-down regulations, or you need just a few, and then you kind of let a lot of experiments play out, and people will adopt what works and let go what doesn't.
Well, if you look at my book, The Structure of Liberty, which is my take on why we have the rights we have.
And that's from 98?
Yes.
Yeah.
But a new edition just came out like a year or two ago with a new afterword. So it's actually available in an affordable paperback edition, because the other one was getting unaffordable. The first part of it is really Hayekian. It has to do with, it says that we have the rights we have because of three basic social problems that every society must confront. Problems of knowledge, problems of interest, and problems of power. Well, the problem of knowledge was Hayekian. Mm-hmm. This notion that we need a discovery mechanism to figure out, to aggregate and somehow coordinate what all of us knows given how ignorant we are of everything else that we don't know.
And in the economic sphere, that's what prices do.
Exactly. Yeah. And I defend that. I use that price mechanism in my book. Mm-hmm. So the first part of it is very Hayekian, but then it's tempered with other insights that where the problems of interest and the problems of power go beyond what Hayek is talking about. Mm-hmm. But that book is an attempt to sort of bring into under one rubric most of the major arguments for liberty. Mm-hmm. And to show how they relate to each other. Not to say there's only one argument, but there are several.
Right.
Because the rights we believe in solve multiple problems in multiple ways. And so there isn't just one reason why they're good. There are multiple reasons.
Right. Talk about Charles Koch. He's, as somebody, he is, funded many, many institutions on the libertarian aisle, or, in the libertarian aisle, let's say. What kind of impact do you think he's had overall on the liberty movement?
Well, as I said, I hadn't seen him for, 30 or 40 years, from the Center for Libertarian days until recently, and I introduced him when he was getting an award, and I said, well, back when I first met Charles, I was just a law student, and he was just a millionaire. We've both come a long way since then.
Yeah.
And I have a world of respect for him. I think what's happened to him, what the left has done to demonize him, is absolutely wrong. I mean, he has to have security with him at all times. There's been all these terrible threats to him. And not only do you have activists threatening him, which is bad enough, but you have government officials singling him out by name for abuse. And
not just government officials,
the president, or presidential candidates like Hillary Clinton, singling him out by name. And this is just wrong in a republic. This should not be happening. And so he's the victim of terrible injustice. And the ironic thing about this is that he isn't the right-wing conservative.
Right.
He is a libertarian.
Well, that's what's interesting. There's kind of a Streisand effect going on where the left needed a villain. In many ways, the right did this with George Soros, a decade ago
or so. Yeah, but rightly so.
Well, I was going to say, but it brought more interest into Charles and David Koch, and David sits on the Board of Trustees of Reason Foundation, and suddenly, you find out these guys are libertarians, they're not conservatives, and it blows people's minds.
Because they're not really bringing their minds to this question to begin with.
Talk about the Federalist Society, because the Federalist Society clearly has had a major role in kind of bringing a new set of conversations and debates to legal education. You were very active in it, from what I understand, when you were teaching at Boston University. And you still are, but what is its role then
in the
libertarian legal movement?
The Federalist Society has had a hugely formative role to play on me. Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't be teaching, I wouldn't be a constitutional law guy if it weren't for them, because I started off as a contracts guy, as a law professor, because when I took constitutional law and I was turning the page of the con law book, all the good cases were bad cases. All the good parts of the Constitution turned out not to mean what we thought they meant, the Second Amendment, the Commerce Clause, nothing. So I said, look, if the Supreme Court is not going to take the Constitution seriously, why should I?
Right.
And given my radical libertarian background, this was not a hard conclusion for me to reach. And so when I became a law professor, first I was a criminal lawyer, mm-hmm. which is what I went to law school to become, a criminal lawyer, and I did that. I was a prosecutor. And then when I entered academia, I did as a contract scholar, because writing still matters, law still matters, I believe in freedom of contract. That's how I started. And then I got invited to a Federal Society National Student Symposium, the fifth one on the First Amendment, held in Stanford. And I was invited by a student who I had met through IHS, and he was, at that point, he went on from Harvard MBA to Stanford Law, and he invited me, and I said, Brian, I don't do the Constitution, so, I don't want it. He says, well, you're a smart guy. You only have to talk for 10 minutes. You can think of 10 minutes of something to say. And it was a conference on the First Amendment, and I really wanted to go because I was an obscure professor at Chicago Kent College of Law, and there were all these heavy hitters there on the panel at Stanford Law School, and I really wanted to go, so I said I would. And it was as a result of writing that paper on freedom of association that I hit upon my interest in the Ninth Amendment, because the Ninth Amendment says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Because I was on a panel on the First Amendment on freedom of association. Well, freedom of association is not mentioned in the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So my challenge
but
to
it's freedom of assembly.
Yeah, but not association.
Okay, right.
So I thought the Federalist Society at that point was a monolithically right-wing organization with no libertarian dimension to it. I was wrong, but I didn't know that. So I walked into the room joking. My opening remarks joked about how I only bought a one-way ticket, thinking that the reception of what I was going to say was so hostile. And so the punchline to my talk about Freedom Association was, because I said, I know what you're thinking, what gives lifetime-appointed judges the power to say that this is a liberty that will be protected, and then, but in the Constitution it says, and then I just said the words of the Ninth Amendment. And this huge cheer and roar came up from the students. They were cheering. And I thought, I must have the Federalist Society pegged slightly wrong. Yeah. And after that, I had to decide, I'm not a joiner, Nick, I'm kind of a contrarian guy. You must know how that feels. And so, you know, I don't necessarily want to be a member of any club that will have me. But I had to decide, do I want to throw in with the Federalist Society or not? Because we don't agree about everything. But the Federalist Society is a coalition. Libertarians are part of their coalition. They're very, very respectful to libertarians. Eugene Meyer, who is the president of the Federalist Society, his dad was Frank Meyer, who was the developer of fusionism, to fuse libertarians with. That's their philosophy. Therefore, I threw in with them, even though I didn't always agree with them, and they've been unbelievably generous to me. It's been one of the greatest professional associations of my life, and they're a wonderful organization. They do wonderful things. But I will say that I believe the organization has moved in the direction of judicial engagement from where it used to be. Things are different in the Federalist Society, and partly because it's a grassroots organization that reflects the tenor of its members. The national organization is super tiny.
Right.
They don't dictate. And the membership has moved in our direction, again, in part because of that salient moment over Obamacare. Things are different now. And so the entire organization has really moved. I debated J. Harvey Wilkerson after the Obamacare case was decided in the Rosencrantz lecture at the Federalist Society in the ballroom of the Mayflower Hotel. And years ago, if there had been that debate versus a judicial restraint guy and me, he would have had the room and I would be the renegade. Yeah. That day, people will tell you, the room was with me and he was the renegade. And that was a sea change, an intellectual sea change that has taken place.
A couple of years ago, I interviewed Mark Tushnet, a Georgetown law professor.
I actually occupy his office. He left Georgetown. Yes. He fled Georgetown as I was arriving, and I got to his nice office.
He had, about 10 years ago, he wrote a book called A Court Divided, and it was about the Rehnquist Court, and he as part of his argument, in which he became increasingly respectful of Clarence Thomas, who had often been kind of dismissed as a lesser thinker and whatnot, but he said, you know, the Supreme Court, it has an effect, but he said that it's kind of noise around zero, in that sometimes it's slightly ahead of where the population is going, oftentimes it's behind, and it actually just kind of ratifies social change. Do you think that that's accurate? And if so, does that mean that a lot of the drama that we see around the Supreme Court is misplaced?
I think it's accurate. I think the Supreme Court, like all of us, are creatures of the moment. We like to think of ourselves as completely outside the moment, but within limits we can't be. Libertarians are more outside the moment than most people because we don't fully buy into. In fact, this was an insight I got from Murray. He said that intellectuals themselves, people who are genuinely intellectuals, are not usually a part of the overall majority. For some reason, they're out. And it's because they're out, they look at what's going on from a somewhat outsider's perspective, and they can see what's going on differently than people that are a part of it. So you don't get more conventionally minded than people that successfully are nominated Supreme Court. These people are the insider's insider. There's no out. I mean, Justice Thomas is unusual because he had a very different route to the court through his activities in the EOC.
Yeah.
But other than that, it was kind of fluky. But mostly, these are the insider's insiders. Mm-hmm. They see things the way and they're people who went through their whole life cultivating their normalcy. We're not like them. So they're very conventional minded, and therefore they're never out too far, or they're ahead of the skis, I think is the way the metaphor works, or behind. You know, they really try to stay the course because that's how they've lived their whole life, or they wouldn't be on the Supreme Court. Nevertheless, at the margin, the Supreme Court matters a lot.
Sure.
ask anybody who now has a right to, ask any resident of D.C. I just bought my first gun last week. Mm-hmm. Never bought a gun. I've shot guns all my life. My dad had guns, mm-hmm. but I never owned one. I didn't want to or need to. Now I think it's a patriotic duty to have one. Mm-hmm. And I bought my first one last week. I live in the district. Yeah. Had it not been for a Supreme Court decision, it would be illegal for me to do what I did last week.
And maybe it would happen, but it'd be 10 years down the road or something.
It wasn't going to happen in D.C. Yeah. I mean, they're still trying to, you know, make it as hard as possible. And they won't allow concealed carry like other parts of the country. So Supreme Court cases do make a difference. If we had managed to strike down Obamacare, it would have made a difference.
Right. Final question. You seem optimistic about the move, partly because of the Obamacare decision, but also because of this groundswell of libertarian legal thinking. Are you optimistic about the future? And what is the one or two things that you could see really blocking forward momentum?
I think I'm normally considered to be an optimist. I'm actually pretty realistic. I was a Cook County State's Attorney. Mm-hmm. I understand what crooked courts are like. Yeah. I understand what the real world is like better than most academics do, maybe better than even some libertarians do. So I don't know that I'm really actually optimistic. Mm-hmm. But I just think you have to have a positive attitude going forward.
Do you think,
I mean, we could be on the brink. I could be on the brink of going in back and be a contracts professor again. Seriously. If the court changes and constitutional law then veers back off into the New Deal direction, do I still want to be beating my head against the wall?
Well,
I don't know.
Do you, I mean, from your undergrad days or from working in your father's laundry, I mean, do you think the world is more or less libertarian?
Well, I've read your stuff, Nick, so
I definitely
have to agree with you about this.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying, you know, because for all of the incursions, all of the regulations, all of the laws, all of the wars, all of the this, all of the that, on another level, you know, things are better than they used to be, right?
I think in many respects things are better than they used to be. I think where things are worse than they used to be is, you know, civil discourse mm-hmm. is not as good as it was once. That's too bad. I think I think where things are worse and where libertarians have not factored this into their conventional wisdom is that the Democratic Party has become a party of the left. It wasn't really a party of the left. It was a liberal party in the social democratic sense of liberal. It's now become a European-style left party since the McGovern thing happened, and then they've just taken over. As well as academia used to be liberal, and now it's left. Mm-hmm. This is all bad. And I think this is one of the several factors that has led to the Trump development. Mm-hmm. Because if you have a European-style party on the left, then to have an American conservative party seems tepid and somehow not appropriate. If there's a natural vacuum left for a European party of the right, mm-hmm. that's very dangerous. And that's very objectionable. That ends up being worse from a libertarian standpoint than a social democratic party is. You have a social, whatever. So things have gotten worse. But on the other hand, and this is going to make me seem like an optimist, things are darkest before the dawn. If I'm right about Ted Cruz being a president who might appoint real constitutionalists to the court and blah, 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 and all the rest, Ted Cruz probably wouldn't be close to Donald Trump now if it weren't for Donald Trump having cleared the field of everybody else. By the time this airs, people are going to know what happened better than we do. Mm-hmm. But there is a possibly good scenario that could come out. It's a low probability event at this point, but it's better than zero that we could actually be in a better place a year from now than we are today. The Democrats are very beatable right now. But somebody needs to beat them with something that's closer to the Republican Constitution I talk about in my book. I think it's down to two guys now on the right side of the spectrum, and one of them, I think, mm-hmm. would be good for this, and the other one would be terrible.
All right. We will leave it there. And the book is Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People by Randy Barnett. Thank you so much,
Thanks,
Randy.
Thanks, Nick.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.